the number one patriarch, Ernest Thatcher Sr. He was, he came from Mount Sterling, Kentucky. He had a third grade education, but he, like so many of other people migrating from the South to the North for jobs, he had a brother who was already in Cincinnati. So he came here, and his brother, and he and his brother were both working on the railroad. And then in the evenings, he would shovel coal into the big houses in Hyde Park. And he had a bicycle that he would ride there. Well, he got a job with a construction firm, Mr. Scully. And he borrowed $500. And in 1932, $500 was a lot of money. But he borrowed the money. He opened up this little storefront. And he went down on Spring Grove near the stockyards, and he bought chickens. And he brought them home, and he and his wife, my grandmother, were cleaning chickens in the kitchen. He was going to work in the evening, shovel coal, and they were selling the chickens. Most of his customers at that time were school teachers from Frederick Douglass Elementary School around the corner. So they supported him. But then he came to the point where he had to tell his wife, he said, look, we got to make a decision because I can't keep doing this and the other job too. So they decided that he was going to do chickens. He was going to do poultry. So he opened up Thatcher's Poultry. And it was on, I think it was 1015 Lincoln Avenue. Well, he started making pretty good money. They were living upstairs above the storefront. Then a building came available across the street. And they bought it. But then he was in the process of buying equipment that was necessary to process live chickens into edible product. But then he decided that he was going to sell fish too. So it became Thatcher's Fish and Poultry. But there was no place for parking because right next to that building was a house. And there's a picture of me somewhere. I had it standing on the bumper of his car in the driveway with that house next door. But then he bought the house, tore it down, and made a parking lot. So now he's got a store with a parking lot and a receiving dock. So now the chickens would come in on Wednesday live, and then we had coops that we would take the chickens out of the wooden coops and put them in the coops that we had metal, and then my job was to feed them. So I put the chicken feed in the things, and I would fatten them up because on Saturday they were going to get sold. Well, Thursday morning, my uncle and my grandfather's number one employee, his name was Rufus Holmes, they would start to kill the chickens. And I was little. He would take a paper bag and roll it up and make a little hat for me. And then he would give an apron, and then he would fold it up so it would be just right length for me. And there's one day this man said, oh, Mr. Thatcher, your grandson, he's working hard back there. My grandfather said, yeah, and when he gets old enough to really do some work, I ain't going to be able to find him. And we both laughed about that. And that kind of happened, but then I came back later. But we would do the chickens, and you could come in on Thanksgiving at that time and select a turkey that was walking and come back and half an hour, 45 minutes, and pick it up, ready to go home, eat it. Same way with geese, ducks, geese. He would go hunting. He was a hunter. He was an avid hunter. He and a number of doctors Dr. Raymond Eugene Clark and Dr. Breedlove. My grandfather was the only one that wasn't a professional. He was just an entrepreneur. But they, all of them liked to shoot. And they formed what was called at that time the Green Tower Gun Club. And they were skeet shooters. And they bought some property up in Blanchester, Ohio. And every year they would have what they called a wild dinner day, where everything that you ate that day was either shot, caught, or trapped. So it was deer and pheasants, rabbits, bear meat. But as a little guy, I would be in the hole when they were competing to shoot. And they would say, pull, and I push the button. And the clay pigeons would come out. And one day he let me shoot his gun. And he and the doctors had these special guns made. They were called Ithacas. And I think I was maybe 10 or 12. And this other guy came up. He says, hey, I'll trade you my gun for your gun. And I looked at my grandfather. And he shook his head. And this guy had an over and under shotgun. It was pretty. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll trade you two of my guns for your gun. I looked at my grandfather like, yeah, that's a good deal, right? He said, no, don't do that. So I said, no. He said, you're a good man. He said, I wish I could have a gun like that, but I can't. And my uncle was the other hunter in the family. My oldest uncle, he didn't hunt. He wasn't a nerd, but he was an accountant. But he was also a trumpet player. He had his own little band, and they traveled around the local Ohio neighborhoods. But his baby brother was a hunter. So he and his father would go hunting all the time. So he has that gun now. And my grandfather, he worked until he died. There was no such thing for him as retired. He worked every morning. He would get up and go to work. I would see that every day. And I think that all of the grandkids saw that everybody got up and went to work. I mean, even as a 9-year-old, I had to work. My grandfather would put us, we didn't work as hard, but we just had to work. I didn't get paid, but you know, we worked for our health. He was so industrious. I mean, he did things that, when I look back on it, he had machines and he had equipment that I didn't see anybody else having. And then not only that, he had two of everything. One broke down, he would pull the other one off and we would keep running it, and then he would go get it fixed. If the fish scaler broke down, he had another one. He had knives, he had everything that we needed to do the job. He had it. I mean, we had machines that would pick the feathers off the chickens. It was automated in the 50s. So I always thought that he was a little genius. And my dad told me the same thing. He said, your grandfather was a very smart man. I'm like, yeah, I know. I can kind of tell. And my grandmother, she was... He was the maintainer. He was the great provider, and she was the maintainer. And she took care of everything. She even went to night school to learn how to do bookkeeping at one time. But she maintained that the money part of the business, and he maintained the equipment, the ordering of the fish, the ordering of the chickens. I used to go with him when he would go down on that. Spring Grove Avenue. We'd go down there and he would pay the bill or he would talk to the guys and I'm just listening, and the guys would come out to deliver the chickens and they would play with me all the time. This guy named Nuthouse, he pulled his knife out. He said, I'm going to cut your throat like you're a chicken. I run. I said, No, you're not. I tell my grandfather, he would say, you better leave that boy alone. And then they would both laugh at me. And he would take me in the truck. Everywhere he went, I went. Everywhere he went, but my uncles taught me most about the business, the cleaning of the business itself. But then I went away, and did a lot of stuff. Well, I had a friend of mine. His name was Edel Figgins. He and I were buddies. And he would always say, man, come on, let's go play. I said, I mean, I got to do this work first. I can't leave, you know. He said, if I help you, we'll get finished faster. I said, okay. So he started helping me every day. Well, he was a twin, but they were not identical twins. They were fraternal twins, and they lived down the street. And one day when I came home from school, Edel was sitting on the steps with this long look on his face. And I said, man, I think I was in the third grade. He was in the fourth grade. I said, what's wrong? He said, his mother died. And so his father was trying to raise those two boys by himself. And that became difficult. But by this time, Edel's been working with us, and he's like another child that my grandparents had. My grandfather, Mr. Thatcher, went down to Mr. Figgins, and they discussed an issue to where Edel would come and live with us. And his brother would stay with his father. So now I got a brother. So my grandmother went out and bought bunk beds, and we got to sleep in the same room, and we flipped coins about who was going to sleep on the top. And it was right across the hall from my grandparents and my grandmother's room. So now I got a brother from the fourth grade until he went to the Navy. He stayed with us. Well, that did cause some animosity between him and his brother, because in essence, he was living the good life now. And his brother, I mean, they were taking baths in the tin tub. You know, so he's now living in a situation where he got tub and shower and bathroom, got his own bed, eats breakfast every morning, we off to school, versus his brother was in a different little situation. So to this day, they don't really get along. But he's in Louisville now, but we talk every Sunday. And he would tell everybody that the only brother he had was me. I'm like, man, you know, don't do that. That's your brother. He said, man, I can't get along with that guy. I said, well, okay. I'm going to always be your brother, no matter what. So he was very close to my grandfather. My grandfather loved him like he was his own child. And he would always say, man, Pops would take me to the side and tell me things. Well, I was more athletic, so I was playing football teams. And as we grew up, all Edel did was work. And he always felt as though he had to earn his way and pay for his way. To this day, he's 68, going on 69, works 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. I said, bro, you got to stop that, man. You're getting too old. He almost had a heart attack. He said he thought he was going to die. They called me, and he had to have blockage removed in his chest. He was mad because they wouldn't release him to go back to work. And so when I called him, I said, I know you're getting ready to go to work. He said, bro, you know me. I'm going to work. I'm going to work. I said, man. I love him to death, but I can't make him stop working. I believe if he stopped, he'd die. And my grandfather, when he passed, he came home for the funeral. And everybody you could think of came to that funeral. Because anybody was hungry, they'd get fed. Between him and my mother, they would get fed. You know, if I don't have no money today, Miss Thatcher, but can I get, yeah, okay, you can get it. You know, they don't do that kind of stuff today. But back then, you know, my mother would just write it down in the book, and when they would get paid, they would come and give her the money. But you had people who were responsible for their obligations, and you had people who were willing to help you without a contract. They helped you on your word. But, you know, that's gone. But when my grandfather, when he got sick, he was, you know, back in the hospital and out, and at that particular time, I was working the Queen City Metro, so I was driving the bus. But I would come up to my grandfather's house during the midday, because I always had a key. But my mother still lived there. So I would come up between split runs sometime and take a nap. But he was in the hospital. I had to go get him and bring him home one day. We were in the hospital, and I'm talking to him, and he said, "Boy, you better go get a haircut." I said, "Yes, sir. Okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do it today." He says, "Reach over there and get my clothes. I got to go." I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I got somewhere I got to go." I said, "Well, Grandpa, I can't, you know, you can't get anything right now." He said, "All right." I think we brought him home. I don't think we passed 2 days later. And when I told my grandmother, that's what he said. She said he did have somewhere to go. It just wasn't with us. I said, "Wow." But he was an avid baseball fan. He played Negro League baseball for a little while. But he was avid when it came to baseball. And his brother-in-law, my grandmother's older brother, lived in Detroit. And he would come down, and my grandmother's other brother still lived in Mount Sterling, Kentucky. He would come up, and they would go to the Reds game. He would go to New York to World Series games. He would go to All-Star games in Chicago. He had a lot of pennants. He had a pennant with the Cincinnati Reds on the pennant itself. The photo of the team was on the pennant itself. That thing was worth a couple of $1,000s, and it was up in the attic. And I found it. My son's he was a football player, but now he's a sports information director at a Wilmington College. His name's Amir Rashid. And so I gave it to him. And I said, "Look, here, I got something for you." So I gave him those pennants, and he was like, "Oh, Dad, where'd you get these?" I said, "Granddad." He said, "Oh, man." He didn't know him that well. But he was just wonderful. They would sit out in the garage and drink old Granddad and listen to the Reds game on the radio and argue about who had the best car, Cadillac or Lincoln. Because my grandmother, his brother-in-law worked for Chrysler. And he said, "A Cadillac ain't worth a dime." He said, "When I came to Detroit, Cadillac wouldn't hire no color people." He said, "I got a job at Chrysler, so Cadillacs ain't worth a dime." And they would fuss about that. And one day, he was washing the car. I may have been 3 or 4. And so he's let me hold the water hose to rinse off the soap. And my grandmother says, "Love, it's a phone call for you." So he said, "I'll be right back." He went in the house. Then my friend Houston's next door said, "Come on, man, let's go play Cowboys and Indians." I'm holding the water hose. So I stuck it in the car window, but it was still running. And when he came out, the whole car water was running out the doors. And he had to go have the whole new upholstery put in. But the thing about it was, he didn't do nothing to me. Nothing to me. He would tolerate the stuff that I did. We would drive from here to Kentucky, and I would ride in the back seat, and I would put my hands down behind his back. He didn't ever say, "Move your hands out the way. You're getting on my nerves." And whatever I did, it was all right with him. And, as a child, you just take it for granted. But as I got older, I said, "God, that guy." He would, when I came home from the hospital, they were hunting. Him and my uncle were in Kentucky, hunting. When they called and said, "Martha Lee's going to the hospital, she's going to have that baby." And the story that I was told was that they came to the hospital, they didn't even change their clothes. They got on boots, and they come to see this baby. "My grandfather wouldn't let you come in the room. You couldn't smoke. You couldn't do nothing around this baby." They spoiled me rotten, and my grandfather did. But you know what? He was from a generation where they didn't do hugs and kisses. Didn't do that. So he never did that. But I always knew that he loved me to death. I mean, he wore me out a couple times. I did something I wasn't supposed to do. He told me one day, he said, "Don't you leave out in front of the store today." I said, "Yes, sir." So when my friends come down the street with their ball back and gloves, and we're going down to Ashland to play ball. "Come on, let's go." I turned around, I looked, I didn't see him. So I took off. And I'm at bat, and the guy's pitching the ball, and all of a sudden he stops. I said, "Come on, man, pitch the ball, pitch the ball." And nobody say nothing. And then I felt this size 13 shoe in my behind. Boom! I turned around, and there he was. And he had walked down to Ashland, which means all the way back to the store. Every three or four steps, I felt the shoe. Boom! And he said, and if you better not run. I'm like, I know I can run and beat him, but if I run, and when he got me in the store, I think he hit me in the head with the Yellow Pages.
When did Kroger open, and when did Thatcher's open, and was there any competition there?
Well, the competition, my grandfather decided that he was going to fill a niche that Kroger's didn't. See, at that time, Kroger's didn't sell fish. They didn't sell fish. They sold chickens. But their chickens were processed somewhere else and brought in. But you still had people from that generation who appreciated the fact that they grew up when chickens were walking around the yard and they were eating chickens, you know. And so they appreciated the fact that they could come in and get a chicken that was alive. And so they would come. But as far as the fish went, we had that locked up. The only other fish market was downtown in Findlay Market. So they weren't really competition. It was people who lived downtown bought fish from them, and people who lived out here. But we had a diverse customer base. We had the Jewish community bought chickens from us because the rabbi would come over, bless the chickens, and make sure they were bled correctly. My grandfather went to learn the Hebrew way of dressing chickens so that he could get their business. So we knew that they had to be bled, and we had a contraption. It was welded, made correctly, to where you stick the chickens in head first, then they wedged in, and they cut the jugular veins, and they bled out completely. They would bless them, and then we clean them, and they would come pick them up on Saturday. But then we also had a big a Japanese contingent of people who would come in because they wanted their fish with the head still on. That was part of the custom. They didn't eat fish without the head. And then we had people who were raised in the South that still had African eating habits that carried over from slavery to where they didn't cut their heads off their fish. So, and then the other thing, technically, is that the best way for a person to find out if the fish is any good or not is if the head's still on it. Because the first thing that dies is the oxygenated gills in the gills. That's the first thing that goes round. So with the head off, you can put a fish off as being something that it's not. No, it's very fresh, but you can't really tell unless you put your hands on it. So we had that market, and every Friday and Saturday, that parking lot at Thatcher's would be jam-packed. That was my job, to go outside and tell people where to park. Because, you know, they would come in and just park any kind of way. No, you got to park up there, you got to park up there, you got to park up there. That was my job. I'd go out there and tell them where to park. If I wasn't riding with my uncle delivering orders, because people call their orders in and we would take it to them. So that was my uncle's job. He was a delivery guy. And I learned how to drive a stick shift riding around with him. Because he would drive and he'd tell me how to shift the gears. Up, over, and up, I shift. He said, okay, straight down, I shift. And so I learned how to drive a stick riding around with my uncle. And we would deliver orders all over. And when we would come back, there would be another load of orders to go back out. And so people would call in, get their orders delivered. People would call in and say, I want 2 and 3 chickens. I want this, I want that. I want 6 pounds of walleye. I want 3 pounds of black bass. My grandmother would take the orders. She would put it in the window. We would clean them. They would come and pick them up. We put them in the refrigerator. They would come pick them up. Names on them, labeled, ready to go. And that was my grandfather's system.
Now, did you also find that there are people who were willing to travel a longer distance so that they could patronize a black owned?
Yes. We had people coming from Hamilton, Middletown. I just met a guy maybe a couple of months ago I was in the doctor's office, and he, I don't know, he overheard me talking to the receptionist, and he said, did you, were you one of Thatcher boys? I said, yeah. He said, man, my grandmother used to bring me down here every Friday to get fish from you guys. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, we lived up in Hamilton. I'm like, Hamilton? Yeah. They came down from Hamilton, Middletown. Not so much on the other side of the river, though. I don't remember many people saying that they came from Newport or, you know, Covington. But on this side of the river, all over town. I mean, they would come past Dave's Fish Market in Avondale. He moved to Mont Hill. They would come past Dave and come to me. And eventually Dave's was bought by a retired police officer. But he would have been better off. I told him he'd be better off being a private detective, because you don't know anything about fish, man. They're eating you alive, because the guys would tell me on the phone what they were doing to him. That he was buying fish from him. I was buying fish from the same people. But I had been buying fish from him for years. And he was saying, man, we just sold him last year's salmon. We got the new shipment coming in. And I'm like, what? They've been in the freezer. You know? He said, I gave him a good deal on them. I said, oh, Bill. He says, man, he won't listen. I said, I tried to talk to him. He wouldn't listen to me. But,
Now, so that I get it on tape correctly, because I actually asked a question, but I didn't get it in your own words, because I think it's significant about black-owned businesses. So put it into your own words.
Well, I would be willing to say that Kroger's as a competitor was a competitor in terms of grocery and deli. They could sell grocery and deli cheaper. But those particular items for us were complementary items. Our market was poultry and fish. So anything that complemented that particular aspect of the business, we had. The other items were just items that neighborhood people would come, milk, you know, you got butter, yeah. But years ago, people would come there simply because they couldn't get any credit at Kroger's. So people in the neighborhood would patronize us.
And why is that?
Well, they, this was before integration. So in a lot of places, they weren't welcome. And, I mean, at that time, the Mance Hotel was, you know, you could throw a rock and hit it. And that was the only hotel that black entertainers who came to Cincinnati could stay in. So we got their business when they came to town. Mr. Gann had a barbershop around the corner. He got all of their business. Nat King Cole, all those guys would get their hair done at his place. And so the Arms Hotel was right maybe a mile away, but they couldn't stay there. So with that being the condition, it wasn't a question of where are you going to shop. It's a question of where can you shop. And so we got all of the business that way. We got all of the African-American business in the neighborhood, all of them. But all of the other businesses in the neighborhood, the same thing occurred. You know, Bernie's Drugstore, the pharmacy on the corner, the doctor's building up the street, the dentist building up on the corner, you know, the restaurants. They were all supported by people in the neighborhood. Because, you know, you couldn't go downtown to Woolworths. They wouldn't let you sit. You could go in and spend your money, but you couldn't sit down and eat a hamburger. And, you know, it was the same way when you went to the shows. There were shows. The Paramount Theater was right up the street from where we're sitting right now. And then there was another theater over on Forest Avenue and the Regal Theater downtown. And those are places that we could go see movies. I can remember being little and going down to the RKO Albee, but we had to sit in the balcony with my mother. Every Tuesday, my mother would go downtown and shop, and because I was there, she didn't have to go to work. But once I got old enough, she had to go back to the store and go to work, and I had to go with her. But Tuesday, we would go downtown, but we had to sit in the balcony, you know. So the people in the neighborhood supported the business, and that was a reliable source of income for that time. But, you know, as I got older and I came back into the family business, you know, we tried to do other things, you know, but the neighborhood started to deteriorate. And my mother and them, they were born and raised on that street doing business there, and they didn't want to go anywhere. And I can understand that. You know, that was my grandparents' baby. My grandmother was still living. And when I came back home, and she was running the business, my grandfather had told her specifically, she said, if I die, sell it. He didn't want to leave the burden on her, but she didn't want to sell it. That was, she was there with him from the beginning. So she didn't want to sell it. And, you know, my uncles, they did other things, you know. My youngest uncle, my mother's younger brother, he worked for General Motors. He retired from General Motors. And my oldest uncle, he was, like I said, he was an accountant. My mother was there always. My mother was what people in that age would say was an old maid. She was married to my father. That didn't work out. She never left home. But she was the only girl. My grandfather's baby, he called her Sissy. And she didn't go anywhere. The story was he told my father, she's not going anywhere. When my father came home from the Air Force, and he was a airplane mechanic, he got a job at General Electric. But my mother wasn't. He said, let's go. Let's start our own family. Let's move out and get a place. She said, well, we can stay here. We got 16 rooms. He was like, I don't want to stay here with your mother and dad. Let's go. She was like, my grandfather said, she ain't going nowhere. So you might as well go ahead on. The baby's going to be fine. He says, I know the baby's going to be fine because I'm going to see to that. But that didn't work. So, you know, my mom was always there. She took care of my grandmother and my grandfather until they both passed. And it sent her into depression. But I didn't recognize it. I didn't recognize it. She was there in that house by herself. 16 rooms, all alone. I said, Mom, sell the house. Get your condo. You don't have to worry about nothing. Nope. I'm raised here. Not going anywhere. And my grandfather would do whatever my grandmother wanted. My grandmother wanted the basement redone because when I was a kid, the coal guy would pull a truck up, put the coal in the basement. We had a coal furnace. My grandmother wanted the new gas furnace. He put it in. But the basement was still unfinished. We had his hunting dogs down there sometimes. She wasn't having that. So there was a home remodeler. His name was Mr. Sikolaki. I never forget him. He came in and he put 3/4-inch knotty pine paneling all in the basement. She had new stove, freezer, bar put in the basement, and, you know, the new couch, and that's my grandmother. She partied. She liked to give parties. And so, you know, my grandfather was like, okay, whatever. And he bought this 1953 Cadillac Coupe de Ville. She had a fit. And he told her, listen, you got everything you wanted. I want this car. So there was no problem with that car. But when he bought this 65 Electra 225, that was a fuss. But he said, that's all he wanted. He drove a truck all the time. He drove that delivery truck. I could hear that truck come up that driveway. And one day my father told me to stand in the corner. I'd done something. He wouldn't whoop me, but he told me to stand in the corner. When I heard that truck come up the driveway, and I knew they were going to be coming in that back door any second, he was reading the paper, and I took off running. I ran in the kitchen and ran behind my grandmother like, now, you can't do nothing to me. And he looked at my grandmother, and he said, turn him over. Well, what did he do? He said, it's my baby. And I found out that he was the boss when it came to me. And I'm like, oh, man, okay, whatever. He still didn't do nothing to me. He just put me back in the corner. That was it. He just wanted to let me know that I can't run to them if I wanted to get. But that was my grandmother and my grandfather. I called him Daddy. And I called my grandmother Mom. One day I told her, you're not my mama. Because I wanted to go swimming somewhere. And she told me, no, I couldn't go. Oh, you know, my mom, she said, you're not going, okay. She said, and I would act up, but I wouldn't act up with my dad. But my grandfather, he never said anything. When that would be going on, he would just look and keep walking. One day, I'm grown now. I got a wife. She had two children when I married her, and I got a baby. But I'm working in the store, and I'm working this other job at Sears and Roebuck. But I'm walking through the store, and I'm mumbling, you know, I ain't making enough money, and it's hard to do this. And I'm just mumbling, grumbling. My grandfather didn't say anything. Finally, he got sick of hearing me grumble, and he stopped me in the middle of the floor. He said, boy, what's wrong with you? I said, Grandpa, you know, I can't make enough money, so and so. He says, well, what, are you planning on walking out in front of a Metro bus? I said, no, I ain't gonna do that. He said, just shut up and live on it, and walked away. And I looked at him, I said, what's that old, is he crazy? I didn't understand it. And it took me maybe a week to figure out what he was trying to tell me. He said, just, you got to live on what you got. We, as kids, they had the Grenadier restaurant. And right there on Monfort's side of the Mance Hotel, great big picture window looking in on the dining area. And, you know, you could see Frank Robinson, Vader Pinson, Hank Aaron when the Braves from Milwaukee would come to Cincinnati. James Brown was here all the time because he recorded a Kings record for Warner Woodward. So you could see him riding up and down the street a lot. But those other guys, we would be standing outside with our baseball gloves, you know, and our balls and our bats waiting for autographs. And they get through eating, and sometimes they would come out and sign autographs for us. We, as kids, we enjoyed it. You know, and then there were some players who wouldn't sign autographs. They wouldn't do it. But that was, it didn't last much. By 1960, between 64, it was over. So then it turned into apartment building. But prior to that, when we were smaller, that was the place. You could see anybody. Cab Calloway, saw him. What was that other guy? He was a singer. He had a big band. They were here.
And then they go to the same barbershop?
Yeah. Well, the men who had the process hairdo went to Mr. Gant, because that's what he did. He was there before there was a guy named John Marshall. He had another shop on the corner of Lincoln and Gilbert that did that same type of hair, but before him was Mr. Gant. And so Gant had pictures all across the wall, all like Sammy Davis, Nat King Cole. He had all those guys' pictures where he was the one who did their hair. I went in there, I said, Mr. Gant, you did all these guys' hair, you just faking? He said, I did all their hair in here, boy. He laughed, we laughed and talked. And because there was a lady who had a little fish bar. She was sold fish dinners right next door to his barbershop. So I would deliver things to her, and then next to him was a lady named Miss Ruby. She had a barbecue joint next to Gant's. And, I mean, that whole block was loaded, but Mr. Gant, he was the man when it came to doing hair. He was the guy. And he just passed a couple years ago. Yeah, he just passed a couple years ago. Because he stayed there. He stayed there while we were open for a long time. He didn't do many of those type of hairdos anymore. That kind of fell out of fashion, but he was still a barber.
That kind of wavy.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah. They called it process. They would put, I begged to get one. My uncle, mother's baby brother, he had one. And he used to have his hair tied up. I thought it was so cool. I wanted to get one. My mother and my grandmother both said, no. You're not doing it. I'm like, please, no, you're not doing it. And my uncle had this reputation. He was Big Time George. Everybody knew my uncle.
Big Time George.
That's, he had a truck, dump truck. Mm-hmm. My grandfather bought him two dump trucks. Bought him a gas station pump so high up on his own property. So he didn't have to go to the gas station. He could come in, fill up. And on the side of his truck, Big Time George. But he was a baseball player. He went to spring training with the Reds. But he got hit in the eye. And you know, when you're a rookie and you come through spring training, something like that happens, they never call you back. And I can remember telling everybody, my uncle played for the Reds. And I'm reading the newspaper every day, George Thatcher did this, George Thatcher did that. And I'm saying, man, and then he came in the store with a patch on his eye. I was like, what are you doing here? Got hit in the eye. Never got back.
I know the other George who was going to play for the Reds, and he was in a car accident. He's in a wheelchair now.
Yeah. There were two guys from here went with him. They went to spring training together. Sonny Webb and George Thatcher. They both went down to Florida. And my, you know, his wife, you know, he was just starting a family, you know, but this didn't work out. So when he came home, he came out of the service, he was in the Air Force. And he went to the Air Force, he was too young, but he lied about his age. I think he was 16 or 17, and he went to the Air Force. And every night, I would cry, you know, because back then, television went off at 11, after the news at 11 o'clock. And they would have, da 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 da, and the airplanes would fly over, and I was like, that's my uncle. I cried, boy. I couldn't wait for him to come home. And my grandfather would just sit there. He would let me do it on his television. He let me do it. He wouldn't make me change the channel. One night, I was sitting in there. Oh, he was, you know, at the time, I didn't pay much attention to it. But he was the sweetest guy. He was the sweetest guy. I mean, my uncle came home from Columbia, South Carolina. He was a lieutenant in the Army. And I was sitting down on the floor watching television. He came in and changed the channel. He was in the bathroom shaving. I changed it back. He came out the bathroom. He changed the channel. I got up. I went downstairs. I said, Grandpa, I'm snitching on him. In other words, he's upstairs changing the channel on me, and he don't live here. He's visiting. My grandfather said, don't change the channel no more. Leave the TV alone. My uncle got mad, got in his car, and went back to South Carolina that night. Yes, he did.
It's a long drive.
He had a Pontiac, green and white Pontiac. He went back to South Carolina that day. I went down there once, my mother, when he had the first child. Mm-hmm. And my mother and I went down. My grandmother sent us down to go help her daughter-in-law with the new baby. And you know, back then they did that kind of stuff. And we got down there, and I wanted to go to the Army base to see my uncle. And when we got on the bus in Columbia, South Carolina, I sat down behind the bus driver, and I'm looking out the window. And he said, whose little nigger is this? My mother was in the back of the bus. He was telling me, get up and go to the back of the bus. I'm like, my mother's saying, come back here. I said, I don't want to sit back there, because I'm from Cincinnati. We could sit on the front of the bus, and I had no problem. But down there, it was different. And I had to go sit on the back of the bus. I was mad. So when we got to the Army base, I had this look on my face like I was so mad. I was so hurt. My uncle said, what's wrong with you? I told him, I said, they made me go sit on the back of the bus. So he took his hat off, his Army hat, his first lieutenant bars on his hat, put it on my head. And we walked up to the front gate, and we stood there. Well, they have to salute the bars. They don't have to salute the person wearing the bars. They have to salute the lieutenant bar. I got the hat on. So they're coming in the gate, and they're saluting me. And I look at him, and he says, salute back. So I'm saluting back. I'm like, yeah, now. And he did that for about 10 minutes. He says, you feel better now? I said, yeah, I'm okay. Let's go. And that was my first experience with that, but that made me feel much better. My Uncle Ernie, he did that for me. And that...